I believe we're on.
We are indeed, yeah. How are you doing this week, Richard?
I'm doing very good. How are you doing?
Very good. Just been, you know, doing the final preparations, did a bit of Christmas shopping here and there.
Good, good. Yeah, I've been doing some of that too. Yeah, and we were decorating my tree yesterday, actually, too. That was nice.
Yeah, it's still standing, is it? It's not.
It's still standing, and yeah. No, I think it's in good shape. We didn't put all the ornaments on one side of the tree anyway, so.
we learned that lesson.
Yeah. We have to have our tree has to be balanced just like our vision, so.
One thing that I wanted to say before we jumped in when we were talking on the podcast, and I said I had something extra that I wanted to talk about but we didn't have time on the podcast. I wanted to talk about something that quite amazing this past week that I found out. I mean, it's something that we already know, but I started doing it myself quite a bit and I felt a lot of improvement. And it was putting cold compress on my eyes.
Yeah.
But doing it like 3 times a day. In particular, first thing when I wake up and then during the day, maybe if I've just got off the computer and then before I was going to sleep. And I noticed a lot of tension get released in my eyes. It was pretty fantastic.
Wow. Huh. We would recommend that for people who have had, you know, trauma or some sort of swelling or overuse. I never really thought about it for your condition. That's good. Yeah.
So I'm interested if everybody could give that a go this week at least, and even if you feel you might not have a particular condition that might be swelling or, you know, anything else like that, then I certainly recommend, you know, putting the cold compress on your eyes just three times a day, just for 7 days, and see if you feel a difference with your eyes. And I noticed a difference to the point where I didn't need to do it 3 times a day.
Wow.
It's in such a short space of time. So anyway, I really wanted to have the opportunity to share that with our listeners because we ran out of time on our podcast. So make sure I got that one out there.
Great. Well, should we proceed with the questions?
Yeah, let's go for it. Let's get it going.
All right. I've got one up on my screen from a former, well, he probably is a current podcast listener who's now turned into a coaching call person. So it says, you've answered my question on podcast number 40. Thank you for that. Wanted to clarify some things about my question. It will probably turn into an even richer question. In the podcast, you said it was helpful to know why my vision is 20/70. The reason is that I have mild myopia and astigmatism. The last time it was measured, it was minus 2.25 diopters on the right eye and minus 1.75 diopters on the left. Maybe we should stop for a second and just explain to people that that's how vision is measured in diopters, and myopia is negative numbers, and farsightedness or hyperopia is positive numbers. And if you have reading glasses for presbyopia, they will also be positive numbers. So when you go to the drugstore and buy lenses for reading, they are what are called plus lenses, and that's this diopter number. So in the drugstore, they usually run from about plus 1 to about plus 3 or so, or maybe a little more, maybe 3.5. And this is just the reverse for myopia. So he has a minus 2.25 on his right eye and a minus 1.75 on his left. So that's close to what I'm left with. It's not so bad, really. And that's why he calls it mild myopia. Astigmatism is a different number on the on your prescription, not this number. Okay. It has been three. What does he say here? on the right and one on the left. It has been, oh, it has been minus 3 diopters and minus 2.5 diopters. So he's reduced it by half a diopter on the right and, ooh, 0.75 diopters on the left. So that's pretty
fantastic.
Good. I improved this while with palming and not wearing my glasses. I'm curious to see how long it's been. After that, I started doing more of the exercises and have been doing that for over a year now. Okay. So probably got a fairly quick response. Okay. There was a time when I stopped doing them, but your podcasts – oh, this is our good comment here. And our podcasts have really helped me get back on track and integrating the exercises into my daily life.
Fantastic. I think we should just stop there and stop do the there. Rest of the coaching call. That's great news. Yes,
it is. What's happening when I look at an eye chart, and this and the same is happening when I do the distance looking exercises. Shifting the short swing. Okay, shifting is for everybody is the moving your eye from detail to detail, smaller than you normally look at. The short swing is just a movement of you hold up your finger and do a quick movement from a sort of a rotating motion, and that's to break up stare and a lot of other things. And the nose paintbrush. So that's the nose paintbrush is imagining you have a paintbrush on the end of your nose and you're kind of tracing things or painting the world with a paintbrush. It's related to shifting. It's more like tracing. Okay. I think this is relaxing my eye, but I don't really know for sure. Let's see. What's he doing? So he's doing swinging. He's doing the paintbrush, and he's doing shifting. Well, the swinging would definitely be a relaxing exercise. The shifting and the tracing, kind of in between. They're not necessarily hard work, but I wouldn't call them relaxing necessarily. But I don't really know for sure. Can you talk a little bit in the coaching call about what strain feels? I do not get headaches when I have strain. Also, with the distance looking exercise, I find it to trace out branches because every time I blink, my vision is different. All right. Ooh, there's so much questions. There are many questions in here. Okay.
Maybe we can stop. Good. Yeah. Let's answer. We're going to answer the first one. That's a really good question there about what strain feels like, and certainly such a big part of our work here is to get to that point of relaxation so that we do know what strain feels like. I know for myself it was pretty it was amazing when I palmed for 30 hours over a weekend. I did 15 hours each day. And at the end of those 30 hours of palming, all I was left with was eye strain, and obviously you could see that as a real negative. But what it was is I allowed my eyes to relax enough so that I could actually feel that strain. Now for me, that strain felt like sort of a dull ache above the eye, maybe behind the eye. How about you, Richard? Is there any sort of things that you would describe about eye strain? I mean, headache is really sort of the advanced version. When people ignore strain for many years, which most of us do, but then say they're at a computer and they just keep pushing and pushing, or maybe one particular eye is a lot, you know, clearer than the other and they really overuse that one eye, then they tend to feel strain more in that one eye. But how would you describe your eye strain symptoms?
Yeah, I think behind the eye is a very that's the way I would experience it. And for some reason, it's behind my left eye, which is not my dominant eye. I normally feel the pain like radiating from behind the eyeball in my left eye. And then it often causes headaches up around the eye above the eyebrow and in the temple. But I could feel behind the left eye, like in particular, that feels like where it's originating. Yeah.
And we should really clarify different levels of strain. For example, you know, like now my eyes don't necessarily feel strained, but I know I've been on the computer for maybe an hour, and I haven't had a chance to obstruct my dominant eye. So I know that my right eye feels like it's starting to work more than my left. I can feel there's a shift there. I can feel my left eye starting to become worked a little bit less, and my right eye is slightly becoming overworked. Now, I wouldn't necessarily call that strain, but you could call it the beginnings of strain. So there's right. there's certainly different levels here as far as strain concerned, and he, you know, might be lucky enough that he's still on the bottom end of that scale of strain. And you know, well, let's hope that he doesn't actually feel strain. But certainly one way for sure is to do certainly a couple of lengthy palming sessions, obviously not 30 hours, you know, maybe just get up early one morning and try and palm for an hour, and then maybe do an activity afterwards like the exercise and see if he notices a difference between the point of relaxation and effort. You know, maybe strain isn't the right word, maybe effort is a better descriptive term for him.
Well, and you brought up another good point in that a lot of times people don't feel strain. This isn't actually an unusual case that we kind of numb out that pain after a while. I don't know if it's the body after you're feeling the same pain over and over, the brain figures out a way to sort of disconnect from that feeling. And so one of the phenomenon we experience with clients is that when they start palming for the first time, and you experience this on your 30-hour palm, you start bringing up a pain that you didn't know was there. And really you're experiencing what your body was already going through but had sort of numbed out. So there is that stage of palming where, oh, you get sort of acquainted with the strain and what it really feels like. So that might be a way of, as you say, bringing on for him to know what a strain feels like is do the palming, and then he actually would feel the strain. So unless maybe he's very young and vigorous or something, and somehow he can get away with this. That's another possibility, I suppose. But I'm guessing it's the other one.
We don't want people, searching for strain. You know, it's great if you don't. Other things would also be, you know, distance looking for a lengthier period of time before using the computer, having a few days break from the computer or the iPhone or from near work. I certainly know strain off that. One thing that was really interesting when I did that cooling that I've been doing over the last 7 days, I started feeling that little ache in my eye that I felt after that palming. I haven't had a chance to think about it too much. I don't know whether it was a shortcut of the 30 hours upon me. I need to play with that a little bit more. But he could maybe always try sort of a scale, you know, try and relax as much as possible, do the palming, and that's zero.
Right.
And then, you know, watch TV, work on the computer, work with, you know, feel the eyes, that might sort of be a one. And then, you know, try and build up where his gauge is. And a lot of it is what you were saying about switching off from the body. It's actually called neuroadaptation, where the brain adapts to a continuous signal. And eventually, you know, if your life's not in danger, just like, you know, if you wear a watch, it might bug you for a few days, and then the brain switches off from it. So, certainly by trying to rebuild the connection with the eyes, which is something that eye exercises do, you know, when you do it over a long period of time. This is why we also recommend a journal, because it can help. You know, you might not notice something now, but in 10 days' time, you might look back and go, oh, you know, I did notice this when I did this, and now, you know, it starts building more pieces of the puzzle.
Right.
And another thing is not necessarily strain in the eye, but it might also be strain in the face. Are you squinting? Do you have any tension in your face? Is your head leaning in towards the chart? You know, there isn't just eye strain. There's also body strain. You know, one way to overcome that is to do the face massage. There is the self-massage exercise in the Eye Exercise Express. So we recommend doing that before doing the charts, and that can help.
And Will's rubbing his face this very minute.
Definitely. Just do 10 minutes of that, and then try and do the chart work. And because your face will be more relaxed, if you're starting to strain in your face, you'll feel it that much more. And if you strain in your neck, and then I guess if we're going to talk about body, there's also mental strain. You know, when you're doing it, are you really trying to push yourself? Are you really trying to achieve a particular goal that could be causing strain, or are you relaxed when you're doing the exercises? So there's certainly a lot more to strain than just within the eye.
Yeah, very good point. Well, and then, well, we could go on with strain and strain and strain. I was just thinking if then those kinds of body issues could then lead to eye issues, you know, way down the line too, because of lack of blood flow and things like that. So, all right, let's continue on with this question. What does it feel like? He says they don't get headaches when I strain. Sometimes they stay okay. Also, with the distance-looking exercise, I find it hard to trace out branches on trees in the distance because every time I blink, my vision is different. This is kind of fascinating. That he's noticing this is very good. Yeah, and it is true that your vision is always changing, and blinking does change it. For some people, blinking clarifies things. For some people, there's this unusual – well, it's not that unusual, actually, case where blinking sometimes makes things blurrier. And again, that's not unusual. So let me think. Why? So every time he blinks – so that disrupts his ability to trace things. I would say that's not a problem. Is that what you would say, Will? It's like, just don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly many reasons why this could be happening. One of them could be that he's breaking the central fixation. You know, I'm assuming this guy's read Aldous Huxley's book, Art of Seeing, or any of Bates' material as well, which they're quite... set on there. They're quite centered on their central fixation.
They centrally fixated on, yes.
So obviously, just real briefly, because this could be a whole topic in itself, but central fixation is because the fovea, which is the detailed part of the central vision in the center of the retina, is what's responsible for seeing fine detail. Now, that's only 1% of the whole retina, so what happens is the eye is designed to target the image or the light right on that one spot. So obviously for that to happen, there's a lot of fine details need to be in place. The eye needs to be aligning pretty well. Now, if you blink, obviously that disrupts that central fixation, and unfortunately in our modern day lives, we've managed to disrupt the natural way that the eye functions. So the saccadic movements where the eye gently moves from point to point, which allows that continual central fixation to occur. So sometimes people might notice the clear vision when they just stare because they're not blinking.
All right.
They've got the image in the line of sight. Everything's lined up on that small point at the back of the retina. Everything's clear. And then they blink, and it disrupts that line of sight that they managed to find. And so they notice that things are slightly blurry afterwards. Now, this is sort of a quick fix, so to speak. And unfortunately, what we have to do is try and avoid that and sort of start going from the blurrier vision and start working our way up to the clear vision as natural as possible.
Right, and you bring up a very good point that we don't really want to encourage this staring as a solution to create clear vision that he's describing. And I think that probably comes from it's a after effect essentially from our lifestyle, as you say, of focusing on type in a book or on a computer screen, and we tend to not, if we're focusing, we're concentrating, we tend to not blink, and we just rivet ourselves to that line, and we do, you know, gather the information, hunting and gathering information, I guess, as opposed to hunting and gathering, where you would be out and you know, there might be points where you're following a zebra or something, and you're concentrating on that zebra as you're about to throw a spear or something like that. But generally mm-hmm. speaking, you're blinking and moving your eyes around from object to object, and you're not as fixated on one point or tracing a line of type. It wasn't what our eyes were designed to do, to trace a line of type like that. As I said, maybe an occasional zebra, but not 8 hours of day. You wouldn't spend 8 hours a day in the wild tracing a zebra across a prairie. It would be gone by then. So that's the difference. Think about that. You want to encourage more that natural blinking and fixating an object, tracing blink. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm moving to another object. There's nothing wrong with that.
He says here that sometimes it stays clear, well, that's fantastic. So that, you know, that shows that the eye exercises are working, everything that he's doing is right. You know, he's starting to get to the point where he can blink and he's still shifting naturally afterwards. You know, the tear ducts are working well and he's lubricating the eye nice and well. So that means the image is coming through nice and clear afterwards. And then where he just says sometimes it's fuzzy again, it could just be that change in habit and the eye, yep. you know, adjusting. It could also be, you know, when things are clear, a lot of the time it also means that we're relaxed. The visual system is relaxed and it's doing what it's designed to do, which is to see clearly. And when we're straining to try and see something, even though it might not be that physical strain that we talk about, if you're trying to force the image to be clear, then you know, a lot of the time it can become fuzzy because you're not allowing the eye to work naturally. So just trying to be as relaxed as possible when doing the exercise. Try not to put, and obviously we know how difficult this is, but try not to put any pressure on yourself to see clearly and just do the exercise and just trust that, you know, as you're doing it, sometimes it might be clear, sometimes it might be fuzzy, but, you know, as the weeks and months go on, the clear bits get longer and the fuzzier bits get shorter.
Good. Yeah, that's very good. Okay, then the last question is non-related to the issue I'm having. It goes into the eye anatomy. I was wondering why the oblique muscles cramp up. Oh, are we talking the muscles? Okay, in the abdomen we're talking about, right? Oh, okay.
The eye abdomen.
Okay, when we're looking at something close. Oh, okay, now I know where he's going. Okay, well, we're using our ciliary muscles to focus on them. Okay, look, the last question, non-related to the issue I'm having, goes to the eye anatomy. I was wondering why the oblique muscles cramp up and deform the eyes when looking at something close while we're using our ciliary muscles to focus on them. Oh, well, okay, that's fairly simple, right? Because so the ciliary muscles are the muscles around the lens that bends the lens to change the shape of the lens, to round the lens, to focus on something close. So when you're reading, the ciliary muscles contract and bend the lens. But the other thing about if you're reading, for instance, is your eyes need to your eye each sees, say, the word thank. Each one sees a separate word thank, and they need to be superimposed on each other, which is called fusion. And so each eye needs to train in a particular angle on that word on the page, and you use the internal extraocular muscles, the nasal ones near your nose. You contract those. There's one at each direction, and then there's two oblique ones that move the eye in a non. Well, anyway, let's focus on the nasal one. So the nasal ones are the ones that bring your eyes and have them focus on the same word, so you can fuse it and read the word. So you're contracting those nasal muscles every time you read. So why is he asked this now?
So a good example of that is if you're listening to this, then just put your finger out in front of you at an arm's length. Look into the distance and then look at the tip of your finger and notice that the two eyes, when they looked into the distance, they were kind of apart. It's called diversion.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the tip of your finger, the two eyes are coming in almost at a triangle. So they're choosing a point. They're starting to turn in. Now keep looking at the tip of your finger, and then slowly bring the tip of your finger towards your face, and you'll notice that the two eyes are starting to turn inwards. So that means that the muscles that are responsible for turning the eye inwards are the nasal muscles that Richard was talking about, and also in part some of the oblique muscles that he was referring to, which are the responsible for making round movements of the eye. So we're overusing those muscles for such a long period of time throughout the day, because we're looking at near all the time, looking at computers, reading, where normally we would be out looking at the distance and the eyes would be in a more neutral state. So what we're saying is just like any other muscle of the body, you know, if you were to stand on one leg for 15 hours a day, well, those muscles in your leg are going to cramp up and you're going to start getting fatigue and it's going to start hurting. Now, he mentions here in brackets, he says the muscles cramp up and deform the eye. So this could be a little bit separate here, and do you want me to go into this, Richard, a little bit more about?
Sure. Go ahead.
Deforming the eye. So this in particular we refer to between the ages, from birth up until the age of 21, where the eyeball is still pretty flexible. So what happens is it's not really solidified yet, so to speak. So when we look from near all the time as children, then those muscles that we talked about turning the eye inwards creates an internal pressure into the eye, and it forces towards the back of the eye. There's a weaker point there, the optic disc, and it elongates the eye, and that's where nearsightedness comes from in children. And a prime example of this is in Asia now, they've got up to about 90% of school leavers now have myopia from where they're looking near all the time, and only 20 years ago it was only 20%. So the ophthalmologists are having to admit now that it's not genetics, and that, you know, it's actually something that we're causing. So for the most part, that's what we talk about when we refer to changing the shape of the eye from looking near. And then as you get older, you know, past the age of 21, then, you know, you've now got that shape, you're kind of stuck with that shape a little bit. So then through the exercises, what we're trying to do is then bring that shape back to its original size again, and lower the degree of nearsightedness.
And then I was going to say, we also seem to hit a fair number of people in their 60s now, too, who, this isn't talked about much, it seems like they're losing the ability to converge. They start to see double, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just guessing here a little bit, but it seems like a lifetime of doing that could be leading to these people losing that ability at some point, and then they can't fuse. So it does have consequences doing that day in and day out for that many years. So okay, I think we finally. That was a really great question, because it went got us in a lot of places.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to listening to the coaching call. So thanks, Tom. We really, really, really enjoyed that. And certainly, that's quite a lot of information there we've just handed out. So certainly feel free to digest it a little bit, and just give us an email, and we'll confirm any points on that. I know it took us quite a while to get our head around some of this stuff, right, Richard?
Yeah, exactly. All right, our next question starts out, hi, Will and Richard, I'm 65 and I've been diagnosed with macular degeneration, and my doctors recommend I wear sunglasses, but your exercises recommend looking at the sun with your eyes closed. How would you resolve this conflict? Yeah, a little bit.
Do you want to start?
Yeah,
with this
start.
One?
Yeah. So the issue of damage from the sun is primarily to do with UV rays. That's sort of the big bad boy out there that the medical profession is worried about. And I think we talked in our podcast about, you know, cataracts. Maybe we might give a nod to that danger for cataracts, but even that, where I guess Will's found some research that suggests that UV rays may not be responsible for cataracts. But let's just assume for 1 minute that we'll give cataracts a nod that maybe you should be careful for cataracts. For macular degeneration, the reality is that number one, well, this is why the lens where the cataract would form is designed to absorb a lot of the UV radiation. So this person may be worried about getting UV radiation to the macula to further degrade it, I suppose. But I guess I'm deflating that argument by saying that the lens absorbs most of the UV radiation already before it even gets to the macula, because the macula is in the back of the eye. The lens is more towards the front of the eye. And then the macula itself has a yellow kind of tint to it, like a pair of yellow sunglasses. And that, again, is filtering out blue and ultraviolet from reaching the macula. That's why it's called the macula lutea, is yellow spot. Yeah, yeah. It's translated as yellow spot. So in that sense, you've got two barriers to UV light hitting the macula. You've got the lens, and then you have this yellow tint to the macula itself. And then we're not asking you to look at the sun anyway. So now you're closing your eyelids, and just in terms of doing the sunning exercise, you're closing your eyelids, and now absolutely no UV light is hitting your macula with your eyelids closed, because they're also filtering out any UV light. So there's absolutely no question that there's no UV light reaching your eyes while you're sunning. So the next point would be, you know, out in the daily world, walking around, again, you would not be, because of the lens and the tinting of the macula, you're not really in danger of UV light reaching your macula. So there's really no danger. And so, and the problem with wearing sunglasses with macular degeneration is the macula responds to strong light. So we in treating macular degeneration, we do want you to rest your macula, because to a large degree, we want you to give it a break from working all the time, because the macula is what the macula actually contains the fovea, which is what Will referred to earlier. So it's looking at detail. In general, the macula is looking at detail, and it's very involved in reading and looking centrally, central fixation, as we said before. So in macular degeneration, we want to rest that. So part of what we do is the palming. We do peripheral work to encourage using your peripheral vision as opposed to your central vision. But then we do encourage sunning for macular degeneration, because the macula is stimulated by strong sunlight, and we want to actually activate the macula as part of the overall program, which includes rest and activation. So if you were to wear sunglasses all the time with macular degeneration, you might actually be sort of like walking on crutches and expecting and then to be shocked that your legs start to atrophy. You know, it's like you're not really giving the macula what it really needs, which is stimulation from strong sunlight. And there's no danger from UV light. So, I mean, I do think we sometimes see clients like this, and they start wearing sunglasses out of fear, and then they become accustomed to them, and then they say, well, I'm light sensitive. You know, it's like, well, actually, you created it by wearing the starting to wear the sunglasses in the first place. And now you really are light sensitive, because you've kind of created that situation. So,
yeah, it's almost like they're acquiring conditions. You know, they have this fear. You've got the psychological fear of being out in the sun. And then by avoiding the sun, the structures of the eye become weaker. So that when you are in the sun, the light does actually seem brighter than it would normally if you had actually spent some time out in the sun. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, yeah. Really. Even things like the pupil, you know, if you're not going out in bright light, then the pupil isn't being given a chance to constrict properly. So it means that you're losing that strength and that flexibility in the pupil to constrict, which is going to, you know, restrict the amount of light that's getting through to the back of the eye. And it's kind of an irony, really, that in a hope to, you know, protect the eye, you're kind of making things worse on yourself by avoiding it.
Yeah, I think that some doctors recommend this for people with macular degeneration, just sort of at a like, well, ironically, they think, well, this, they can't explain what the danger is, but it's just like, well, you're taking care of your eyes. And we think we've been sort of educated, or I don't know what you want to call it, deluded to believe that wearing sunglasses is an inherently like brushing your teeth. It's a healthy thing to do. I don't know who came up with this, but it's like taking care of your eyes, putting sunglasses on when it's sunny out. And I would guess that at least 50% of the population believes that.
Well, the advertising people have done a good. We won't go there now, but certainly they've come around in the last 50 years. All of a sudden, 50 years ago, people didn't wear sunglasses, and yeah. The last couple of million years, they didn't need to wear them.
yeah, exactly.
But I also think if you think of the back of the eye, where you've got a protective sheath that protects our eyes from the sun. And if you think of somebody, say myself from my native country of United Kingdom, where we probably only get sunshine for about 2 days of the year. No, it's probably not that bad in the south. But maybe if you think of somebody in the north, somebody that has, real fair skin, they're never out in the sun. And if they do, then they've got a higher chance of getting sunburn, whereas somebody, say, in California, that spends a lot more time outdoors, a lot more time in the sun, well, they've built up a natural resistance to the sun. So, the eye is the same. The eye has the same layer that the skin has that protects us from those sun rays. So just going on the basic principle of if you don't use it, you lose it, then if you're not going out into the sun and you're not allowing the eye to receive sun rays, then it's losing its defense mechanism.
Yeah.
So it's all cycle.
Yeah, it is. Well, and there's a lot of people out there that I just meet casually who cannot go out without sunglasses. They just can't do it. And I try to tell them that it's an acquired skill. It's a natural ability, and you can acquire that ability back. But you have to be motivated. So, and most of our listeners are, fortunately. So,
yeah.
All right. So, one last. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if anyone's interested in the actual medical term, it's photophobia. If they want to look that up, and it seems, from our point of view, quite a lot of it is the psychological aspect, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, to me, it's acquired, though, too, that people, yeah. It doesn't take long for people to become photophobic with just a habit of, like, a doctor says, why don't you buy some prescription sunglasses? They start wearing them, and within a very short period of time, they're really stuck on them because they really can't, their ability goes away to adapt, so...
Certainly our listeners just need to be aware with something like that. There's quite the combination of psychological and physiological factors. It's going to take longer to build up the confidence and to build up the strength in the eye.
So that's true.
You really have to be real patient with that one. And maybe you go from wearing sunglasses just to wearing a hat when you're out, and maybe you only restrict yourselves to early mornings or late afternoons. Build yourself up to it.
Good point.
If that's the case and that's you, then certainly don't put too much pressure on yourself to overcome any fears of the sun or indeed straight. It'd be like someone from Scotland going out to the Middle East and sunbathing in 120 Fahrenheit.
yeah. No, you're right. You're You're totally right, because we've seen a huge, there is a scale or a spectrum of people with photophobia. And I guess I was referring to the person, the average person who just puts their sunglasses on every time they go out. They don't think about it. They could probably wean themselves from them in a month, is my guess. But then we have seen clients who are seriously photophobic.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have even developed it themselves, you know, without the conditions they have.
Yeah. And you know what? It's one of those things that people don't know that have. Nobody even realizes that they're afraid of the sunlight until we go, right, we're going outside to do something without any sunglasses. And all of a sudden, you know, it's a really difficult thing to do. So it's amazing how many people don't even realize that they've acquired this over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
All right. So our last question comes from a person with glaucoma, and they say, I've noticed on the website and in your information that you recommend that people with glaucoma do not do palming for more than 10 minutes. What's that about?
Ah, good. Good question. Observant to the instructions there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
go.
Yeah, we get to get into anatomy again, which is our favorite realm, especially the eye anatomy. So let's back up then. So the front of the eye is the cornea. The very front surface of the eye is the cornea, the clear part. And behind the cornea, you have the pupil. And then you have the lens, and that's called that. Will, help me out. That's the front chamber of the eye, and I'm blanking on the Latin name for that. Anyway, there's the front chamber of the eye, and then the back chamber of the eye, which is called the vitreous humor in the back, and the front is filled with aqueous humor. So think of the eye as having two chambers essentially, and those two chambers are separated by the lens. All right. So, and the aqueous humor is, what's the word? Produced, that's the word, is produced in the around the muscles of the ciliary body. And then it flows. So you've got let's forget everything behind the lens for a second. So the lens is the back surface we're talking about. And the fluid is being produced around that lens and being pumped into, say, around the lens. So the next structure above the lens towards the front of the eye is the pupil. Well, that fluid has to go kind of through the opening of the pupil, and then it goes into these side ducts, essentially, called the canalis schlemm, which drains into to the nasal passages, essentially. Anyway, so that's the flow of aqueous humor, and glaucoma is a buildup of pressure in this front chamber beyond normal. And so that it's this fluid that builds up the pressure on the eyeball. So when you're palming, you are dilating the pupil back from a small point, small opening, to a larger opening. And this just the geometry of it. The lens is a curved surface. Sort of think of the lens think of the lens as sort of a round hill. And above that round hill, you've got like an oculus. So that's the pupil. It's got an opening in the middle, and then it's a big circle the opening can be big or small above that mound. So as it comes out, there's a point where in the midpoint of the midpoint of dilating the pupil, where it gets close, the distance between the pupil and the lens becomes closer. Just the geometry of the curve of the lens and the opening in the pupil, and that's creating kind of a what's the word? Backlog, not the bottleneck. That's the word there for the fluid, and so that's what that's why we recommend only doing it for 10 minutes, because we don't want to create that bottleneck for long periods of time if you have glaucoma, because you are sensitive to increased pressure. So in theory, that bottleneck could create an increase in pressure.
Wow, good job.
Good job? thank you.
that's a difficult one to describe verbally. But certainly, I think a lot of people will find this a lot more with closed angle glaucoma, because that's where that angle is already the corner of the trabecular mesh that Richard's talking about there in the corner of the eye, where the fluid drains out. If you've already got a tight angle there with closed angle glaucoma, then it means that, you know, when the pupil's dilated, then it's got more of a chance of covering, you know, covering the mesh up and it restricting the amount of drainage of the aqueous humor. Now we just say for everyone, you know, everyone with glaucoma, because we can never really tell whether they have closed angle or open angle. So just to be safe, we recommend that for everyone. But this is also why those that do have closed angle glaucoma and wonder why their doctors say that their pressure's higher first thing in the morning. That's because during the night, you know, you're sleeping, your pupils are more dilated. So it's kind of doing that a little bit. You do get drainage. They've just done a new study and found that you do get like maybe 10% of drainage through the eyelid. So actually going out through a little vessel there. That's helping to drain it out into the blood. So, but that's only a small amount. But certainly, you know, that's why we want to avoid that. And that's why the sunning exercise is so beneficial as well for people with glaucoma, because you're constricting the pupil instead of dilating the pupil.
Right.
So,
I guess you could say that there's another reason. If you had glaucoma, and you spent all of your waking hours indoors in dimmer light, because everything's dimmer than the sunlight. No matter how brightly you light your home, the sun is so much brighter. That if you had glaucoma, we could say you need to be outside more, because you need more of a dilated pupil in general. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it all follows. It really all follows that if we do what our eyes were naturally designed to do, they're healthier in every way. So. It's not that complicated. So.
Yeah, but that's a good question. That one, and a few people picked that up. So I'm glad that the individual figured that one out. So good work for them. Okay, great. Well, I'm not seeing any more emails coming through. So if you did send us an email over the last few weeks, thanks for sending your questions in, and don't forget you can send it in over the next 2 weeks. Granted, it will be the Christmas period, but hopefully we'll all be back and ready in place to take the next coaching call. If not, we might need to move it to a Tuesday, because I am actually flying in on that Monday, but a little bit earlier in the day, but it might be a bit close.
Now, I hate that. I can't believe that we're dealing with this, but the reality is there are actually 5 Mondays in December this year. So actually, it's the 5th Monday in December. So the first Monday in January is actually, I don't know what the date is. So actually, if we did it on the 5th Monday of December and then the first Monday in January, they would be in consecutive weeks. So we're not going to do it on the 31st. You can come back and go to sleep after your long flight home.
I can rest. You could tell I was worrying about it already.
So, you were definitely worried about that. No, but that would be silly, because then we would be doing the next week. So we will see everybody on the first week in January.
Fantastic. And if everyone just keep sending in their questions. One thing that can be helpful is to stick the word coaching call in the subject, and then it's a little bit easier for us to keep track of them when they come through as well. And we definitely know it's for the coaching call. So that's pretty helpful. So all right, great. Well, you all enjoy right. The rest of your couple of weeks, Richard. And I guess I have to wish all our listeners a happy holidays, and we'll speak to them all in the new year.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Talk to you all later.
Bye. Bye.